Welcome to Eastern Standard, an episode 24 of our special series, Democracy Optimist.
What does it mean? To be American.
Our series host is Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law, where he focuses on election law and voting rights. Democracy Optimist is produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. This week, civics, and where the rubber meets the road far more often and with far more direct impact on our lives than what's happening in Washington. In Lexington, for example, the nonprofit group Civic Lex is working to keep everybody up to speed on what's happening in local government. They go to public meetings and provide coverage of local civic issues. Next March, Civic Lex is hosting the city's first ever Civic Assembly, where the public can recommend potential changes, updates, or improvements to the Urban County Charter. That's the rule book that outlines how local government is set up, what it's allowed to do, and the rules it has to follow. It was last updated in 1998. We'll have more on this soon. This week, we look at local civic engagement from both 10,000 feet up and from ground level through the perspectives of a PBS host and also from a key member of Lexington's Urban County Council. Here's Josh Douglas.
Many people have asked me about the name of this show, Democracy Optimist. Can I really be optimistic given everything that has happened recently? My answer is simple. Optimism does not mean I think everything is great. It's about hope for the future and what we can become as a country if we remain clear-eyed about the risks and take bold action to save our democracy. It's a statement of intent. That starts, in my view, with civic education, which is why I am so excited to speak with our guest today, Ben Sheehan. Ben is the host, writer, and producer of Civics Made Easy, a series on PBS that empowers viewers with the knowledge necessary to participate in democracy. He also writes a Substack titled Politics Made Easy. He is the author of the best-selling book, What Does the Constitution Actually Say? A non-boring guide to how our democracy is supposed to work. Basically, Ben has done it all in trying to explain our Constitution and democracy to a wide audience. I actually had the pleasure to be interviewed by Ben for the PBS series, Civics Made Easy. So now the roles are reversed, and I have the honor of learning from him. Ben, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
I'm optimistic and happy to be here.
Great. Well, where did you gain that passion for optimism through civics education and then wanting to educate others?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I had one parent who worked in the United States Senate, and she had a 15-year career, and she would come home and talk about the things that they were able to accomplish that day, things like funding for NPR and PBS and early childhood education and the arts and all these different things. And I really got conditioned on understanding that the government is designed to benefit us and make our lives better. And I got to see examples of that every day just through the work of a parent. And I got these civics lessons from her and my dad over the dinner table for many years. And so I kind of grew up just with the luck of having parents who would educate me and gave me a civic fluency and an ability to understand the government and understand that it can sometimes be used to do things that do benefit our lives.
Isn't that a little idealistic these days? I mean, you know, many people don't think the government is actually able to accomplish much in terms of good and helping people. And, you know, do you still have that sense of, you know, the government is there for us?
I think of it in terms of different levels of government. And I certainly agree that right now the federal government seems pretty bleak and that people are more obsessed with fighting on X or scoring political points and then fundraising off of that with text messages and emails to us that we all get constantly and are annoyed by. So it does feel that at the federal level, there's just more partisan warfare and a reality show. But I also understand, and I know you do too, that that is just one level of government that affects our life and that our state government affects us arguably more than the federal government, and on down to our county and our city. And if you look all across the country, there are constantly examples of local and state governments making things better for people that don't get covered in the national media. Maybe they get covered in local outlets like yours, like NPR or PBS in local markets, but they definitely don't make the national news. And so I think we're constantly presented of examples, high profile examples of government not working, and the moments where it does just get buried under the rug.
Yeah. So a part of that is the explanation you like to do through the various outlets, right? Through the PBS series and your book. What does the Constitution actually say? A non-boring guide to how our democracy is supposed to work. What makes this non-boring?
Thought you might ask that. So the reason I call it a non-boring guide is I wanted to take out all the stuffiness and the pomp. And this is not a criticism of professors like yourself. But there are some people who tend to overcomplicate things. And look, obviously, the Constitution is both short and complicated, written in a dialect of over 200 years ago. Words don't mean the same thing today that they may have meant back then. And so it's hard to parse out. So I wanted to take the experience of just me as a friend sitting with somebody at a bar for 3 hours, 4 hours. How would I break down the Constitution in the simplest way possible? And also, what examples and analogies could I use from pop culture and current day to help illustrate what the provisions of the Constitution actually mean? So it has the feel of a conversation, hanging out with a friend. There are jokes, there's levity, and hopefully that makes the information go down a lot smoother.
How do we get people to do that, to go hang out at a bar and talk about issues of democracy? I mean, you know, you go to the bar and you debate the latest football scores or latest scandal in Hollywood. But you seem, you know, to want to get people to have those barroom conversations, but about the Constitution, and you wrote a book doing that. How do we get people to actually do that on a more prevalent scale?
So I had an epiphany a few years ago, and it actually led to me writing the book, which is I would do voter turnout work in 2016 and 2018, sort of fusing the entertainment world and the political world to help get young people engaged and to register to vote and to vote. And I would hold events, and we would have representatives from states across the country come and speak, or somebody who was a secretary of state in a state like Michigan or Georgia or something like that. And they would come speak, and there would always be a portion for questions after, right? And no one would ask a question. No one would raise their hand. And then afterward, people would come up to the speakers on the panel and ask their questions individually. And I would go, well, there was a section for questions. Why didn't you raise your hand? And they all had the same answer. I didn't want to look dumb. There is a massive crisis of people not participating in government, not wanting to talk about government in any kind of public setting because they feel ashamed for not understanding how it works. And that's what led me to look at the state of civic education in the country. And, you know, yes, most states do require some amount of civics, but it's pathetic. I mean, only 7 states require at least a year. Most states require half a year. And we're talking about between kindergarten and 12th grade. And a lot of states require none. Most states don't require any kind of civics test to graduate. So we're not teaching this stuff. The only reason I went to school in D.C., by the way, a few miles from the Capitol, and I got half a year in 8th grade, and that was it. And the Capitol's literally down the street from my school. So we're just not teaching this stuff in the same way that we used to many decades ago. And as a result, we're graduating people who are embarrassed to talk about this because they don't want to seem stupid. So if we can all just lose the shame, shake it off, understand that it's not our fault if our schools didn't offer it or you didn't have a parent who happened to work in the Senate and teach you, and all admit that we may not know as much as we'd like to, and let's all get caught up together. And studies show that people do participate more if they understand how government works. So hopefully the work that you do, the way that you educate people through your show and through your classes and your books and the way I do it, we can all get people more informed so they can have those conversations at bars.
What's your reaction to the states that have passed civics requirement, but the requirement is that to graduate from high school, you have to pass the citizenship test, the same test that new citizens have to pass? I have my own views, but I'm curious for yours. Is that a good approach, or is that leaving a lot on the table?
Well, the citizenship test is only 6 out of 10 questions. So if you were to give all 100 questions, you know, maybe that seems more like a test that could be passed. You know, studies also do show that only about 1 in 3 people born in the United States can actually pass the citizenship test, which is not great. If I were to wave a wand and somehow convince every state education superintendent or education board or school district to, you know, require the proper amount of civics education, I would do 3 full years required. I would do 1 in 4th grade, I would do 1 in 8th grade, and 1 in 12th grade, sort of different stages of your life. So you get a basic familiarity at a young age, a little bit more hands-on when you're, you know, a young teenager, and then when you're getting ready to graduate and becoming an eligible voter, you get more hands-on education. And it wouldn't just include education about the federal government. It would include your state, your city, your county. You know, if we barely cover civics at the federal level, we definitely don't cover it at the state or local level. So I don't have an issue with requiring the citizenship test to graduate. If that's what schools decide that they want, I would hope it would be more than 10 questions. But I do think there should be some kind of civic test, aptitude test, in order to graduate from school.
My own view is that states say you have to pass a citizenship test and then think they've fixed the problem. And that test is mostly rote memorization. It doesn't actually show you how government works. And as we were discussing earlier, how government can make people's lives better through real processes that they actually have an effect on people's lives. And so I favor, in fact, you know, there's a school in Washington, D.C. I wrote about in my first book that required students to graduate to engage in a local action civics project where they actually had to get involved with the local government. And to me, that is even a better approach. I mean, I guess I'm fine with the citizenship test if that's part of the curriculum, but I think people need to be engaged in how it affects their everyday lives, which leads me to my next question for you, which is, you know, you mentioned the school, the K-12 civics problem, but you seem focused on educating adults, you know, who are already out of schooling. And yet people are busy. You know, we have work, parenting responsibilities, everyday lives. How do you get them to embrace the importance of this topic with everything else going on?
Well, I do it in really bite-sized pieces on social media. So most of the things that I post and upload are, you know, 60 to 90 seconds. And, you know, at some point in the day, someone can probably find a minute or a minute and a half to watch a video explaining something, the fundamentals and the basics of something that they saw happen in the news. I do think that as people get older, they actually understand the importance of government more. They see the impact on their life when it comes to the cost of housing, when it comes to, you know, zoning. Housing is such a huge issue right now, and I think it didn't really get fully appreciated in the last election. And that's largely a state and local issue. In fact, I was part of some focus groups that interviewed voters under the age of 30, and it didn't matter what state we were in, what the demographic makeup of the groups were. Every single group of young people under 30 said that housing was their big issue. And that's something that is directly impacted by state and local governments in terms of where you can build single, family housing versus multi-unit, how expensive it is to build these units of housing and what kind of regulations you can go through. It's much different in California than it is in Texas. And so I think as people get older, they start to see the impact of government on their personal lives. I mean, student loan reimbursements, even to bring it back to voting, the way that we vote, whether we can vote by mail or in person, if we need an excuse, stuff like that. Basically, everything that we do is somehow impacted by the government, and we don't really understand that until we get older. So now we have an audience. I have an audience on social. Other people who do this work also are building audiences on social that understand that this is something that's not just like a snooze class in school. It directly impacts their life. And I think there's a general understanding that civics and personal finance are probably the two most important subjects that we could learn in school that we definitely don't get enough of.
Yeah, and to that end, Kentucky did pass a law recently to require both financial literacy and civic literacy as part of a graduation requirement. And so that's just being implemented now. And another example of how in this space in civic education and voting rights, Kentucky actually has been a model in recent years for places around the country. We're talking with Ben Sheehan, who has a new PBS series out called Civics Made Easy. Ben, there have been major cuts to public programming and really a lot of attacks on civic education in general. How do you think that impacts the work you are trying to do?
Well, it's definitely been disheartening to see PBS specifically become so politicized. You know, obviously growing up, I had an appreciation for shows like Sesame Street and Square One and Mr. Rogers that taught me a lot of basics. And I think the understanding, at least among for my mom and other people who worked in government, was that this was a way to provide quality early childhood education and resources to people that maybe don't have access to good preschools or great teachers. And so it gave a real service. And today, local PBS affiliates do things like, you know, emergency alerts, or they do local news. I mean, you're very familiar with this, hosting a show on a local NPR station. It's not just yelling about the federal government and what divides us at the, you know, national level. There are things that get reported on, and oftentimes PBS or NPR are really the best local news option in various communities. There are 1,600 stations total between PBS and NPR across the country and local affiliates. And so the federal defunding, which is about $550 million a year that gets spread across the two, you know, most of that money goes to local affiliates. It doesn't go to, you know, the national programming for PBS or for NPR. And so really what these cuts are doing is they are depriving local news stations and local radio stations of resources and things that inform people about what's going on in their city or their town. So I hope that, you know, social media accounts like mine, shows like mine, books like mine, the work that you do, the work that a lot of other people in the space are doing, can make up that gap. Because as that funding goes away, then important civic and news coverage goes away.
So let me tell you a story that informs the current project I'm working on, and I'd love to hear your reaction. Right after the November 2024 election, I saw a handful of news stories talking about how voter engagement was really high, that it was a very high turnout election. It was the second highest in a century, second only to 2020. And yet voter turnout was 63.9% nationwide. Over a third of the eligible electorate did not show up. In your work, you've talked about ignorance as a big threat to democracy. There's also concerns about disillusionment. So how do we think about the voter turnout issue in this country as it relates to your work on civic education?
In the same focus groups where housing was the number one policy, we also did a survey about people who don't participate. And to your point, 90 million people, give or take, every presidential election who are eligible to vote do not cast a ballot. And the reasons through these surveys, now this has to do with voters under the age of 30 or 35, but the reasons that a lot of these voters gave, or non-voters, I should say, gave, is that they didn't, there are some people who are always going to vote, a small, you know, let's say call them 14% or so of young people will always cast a ballot, they're civically engaged, et cetera. And then you have people who just have no interest in politics. They think it's all corrupt. They're more of the, you know, cynical, burn it down, tear it up from the roots, start over type of crowd. Again, that's a pretty small minority. But then you have this big chunk of people, and there are really two reasons that they self-report not voting and not participating. One is that they don't believe government is effective. They haven't seen examples of government benefiting their own lives. They haven't seen government benefiting the lives of people that they love or care about or that are friends of theirs. And they think that it just creates more problems than it solves. Now, that can be solved by showing people exactly, you know, the things in their lives that government does affect, because I think that does relate a lot to civic education. But I certainly don't fault people for being disillusioned about government, especially in this current climate. I fully understand that. But I do think that there are examples that they may not be hearing about in the media, and understanding the direct connection that government may have on their lives and actually the ability that they do have to affect it at the state and local level. And the second reason is that people say that they don't understand it, and that is a huge barrier to participation. So theoretically, of the 90 million people who don't cast a ballot, 30 million may be not movable. 30 million could be moved given examples of government actually working that they may not be aware of. And 30 million could be moved to vote based on understanding more about how it works. And that's all self-reported.
That's really fascinating, and I think that's useful for, again, my project, which I'm looking at the issue of non-voters. Do you think that would change election outcomes and thereby change policies?
I think it would drastically change election outcomes. I can't say that it would necessarily change outcomes immediately at the federal level, but at the state and local level, where, you know, only a few people turn out in local elections. I live in the Los Angeles area, and Los Angeles, you know, primary elections, I mean, sometimes you get turnout levels of like 8 to 12%. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And, you know, someone once said the further you move down the ballot, the closer you get to your front door. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true. And these elections that are arguably the most impactful and, you know, affect us day to day have the least turnout and the least awareness. So I do think that, you know, educating people more about government, showing them these examples of government actually affecting their lives in a positive way, or having the potential to do that, would absolutely change what every city and town and state looks like. And if it gets to a certain level, the federal level as well.
I love that you're talking about the impact and role on local government and local elections, because that's my same response as well. You know, I think if the other 90 million voted in the 2024 election, Trump might have won again. Harris might have won. I think there's some conflicting data that's out there. But surely we have essentially results that are, I don't want to say random, but almost random at the local level when you have these super low turnout elections. I saw one, I think it was 2015's Dallas mayoral election, had a turnout of 6% of the eligible electorate in, you know, a major city. So we have a democracy problem, I think, that can be solvable by some of the things you are talking about. But that leads me to my next question, which is, how can people get involved? You know, what's one thing that individuals can do to help save democracy?
Well, I'll give you an example. A few months ago, I went to a town hall for my local city council person. And I live in a city of, say, 150,000, 170,000 people. I think there were 40 people at the meeting, maybe. And the fire chief was sitting there, and the police chief was sitting there, and my city council person. And they were kind of like, you know, here's what's up. Do you have any questions for us? That was a pathetic turnout. And people don't know about these opportunities to interface with their representatives. Another thing that is really important, I think, for state politics is to understand what's happening in your state capital city. I always suggest that people subscribe to the main newspaper in their capital city, because that tends to have the best coverage of the state legislature and the laws that are coming out of the state house or the state capital, I should say. And then the same thing for the, you know, local outlets in their city or their county, so that they can get good coverage of what's happening at the local level. There's a huge list, obviously. Yes, registering to vote, volunteering at polling places, joining civics groups, single issue groups, whatever it is. But on a basic informational level, if you have the opportunity to go to town halls, especially for, you know, local reps, do it. If you have the chance to subscribe, if you can, if it's, you know, free, great. If you need to have a paid subscription, if you're able to afford it, if you can subscribe to the main news outlet in your state capital, so you have a better understanding of what state laws are coming down the pipeline or state constitutional amendments. And then I would also say, on a bigger scale, getting familiar with the ballot measure process. If you happen to live in a state that does allow for ballot measures, which, as we know, was only about half, maybe a little bit more than half, understanding how that process works, and also understanding it at the city and the county level, because if your reps are not listening to you in a lot of cities and a lot of states, you have the ability to do something about it yourself.
Ben, tell us how we can find you on social media and elsewhere.
You can find me on Substack. My Substack is called Politics Made Easy, and my Instagram handle is Ben Sheehan, and it's Ben Sheehan across most social platforms.
Ben Sheehan is the host, writer, and producer of the PBS series Civics Made Easy, and the author of the book What Does the Constitution Actually Say? A Non-Boring Guide to How Our Democracy is Supposed to Work. Ben, thanks so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, you just talked with Ben Sheehan, who's the host and writer-producer of Civics Made Easy on PBS, and you ask him how civics may be never more important for all of us to understand than it is today, and yet something that hasn't been much of a priority in education. How to get everybody interested in learning how civics work? What stands out to you from how Ben answered that?
I love the way he talked about having conversations regarding issues of democracy, of civics, in a bar, right? Going with your friends and sitting around and talking about issues in a fun way. It doesn't have to be boring. It doesn't have to be technical or have a lot of legalese involved. You know, he's really dedicated at making this stuff easy and understandable. And that image of people going to the local watering hole, going to a restaurant, sitting around with your friends, or maybe it's a coffee shop, and sitting around and talking about the issues of the day, and doing so in a way that's both informative and entertaining. I think that's really important. To me, civic health has to be part of the everyday experience. It has to be the sort of thing we talk about on a daily basis as a normal routine thing. We shouldn't need to set aside, okay, this is our civics education moment or the civics education portion of our conversation. I think what he's really trying to do is make that part of our everyday conversations. And that image to me, I keep going back to, of sitting around with your buddies at the bar or at the coffee shop and talking about these issues really resonated with me.
What else stands out to you from what Ben had to say about civics education and about the conversation around it?
I thought it was interesting when he talked about going to his own city council meeting or meeting with the city council member and the fire chief, and so few people were there. It demonstrates that these issues impact people's daily lives, and yet we, you know, scream at each other on social media about what's going on in the federal government and don't engage enough in our local conversations. And so I thought the other aspect of the civics education component is really becoming involved in local government and showing up for these kinds of meetings. Maybe put down your phone when you feel like sending off a screed on social media about what you're hearing coming out of Washington, and instead engage in local government and local democracy.
In a moment, Josh and his guest, Lexington Vice Mayor Dan Wu, will bring all of this home. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. The focus of this episode is local government and civic engagement. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas.
As I often say, optimism does not mean I think everything is great. It's about hope for the future and what we can become as a country if we remain clear-eyed about the risks and take bold action to save our democracy. It's a statement of intent. And one part of doing so is to focus on our local communities. Although it may seem impossible to impact national politics, people can surely make a difference right where they live. That's exactly what today's guest, Dan Wu, has done here in Lexington, Kentucky. Dan is the vice mayor of Lexington and is the first Asian American to serve in that role. He served on numerous local boards before winning election as vice mayor, but before that, he had little experience in politics, instead opening his own ramen shop and appearing on the TV show MasterChef. Vice Mayor Wu, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So it's not every day you hear about the ramen restaurant chef, government pipeline.
Uh-huh.
You know, why did you decide to hang up the kitchen utensils and run for office?
Yeah, it is a very atypical pipeline. To be honest, COVID. COVID came along in 2020 and just really knocked us for a loop in the hospitality industry, and I wasn't able to continue doing my restaurant business. So as that kind of faded out in 2020 to 21, I was literally looking for what my next thing was going to be. And, you know, in the previous recent years, I'd been getting more and more involved in community, doing organizing, fundraising, just working with a lot of nonprofits and really thinking about how do I help make Lexington a better place. And then I heard about, a seat opening up on the at-large council in Lexington. And in 2022, I thought I'd give it a shot, and here I am.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about that time period. The restaurant business is hurting because of COVID. You're working with these nonprofits. What are you learning as part of the nonprofit work that leads you to think, maybe I could do this and run for this open seat?
Yeah. You know, as soon as COVID really solidly hit us, I mean, I remember the date. It's March 16th when the governor ordered that all restaurants needed to go to go and take out only. Mm-hmm. That was the day that, you know, most of us kind of either shut down permanently or at least temporarily. And me and my friends in the restaurant industry, we kind of immediately got to work, figuring out what are we going to do with all this food in our coolers, trying to donate them to various nonprofits, but then also realizing suddenly we would have thousands and thousands of restaurant and hospitality workers out of work. So we kind of immediately got together with a bunch of us and started doing essentially mutual aid relief for providing, you know, using some of our kitchen spaces. Worked with Lotta Swan from Great Bagel. We mm-hmm. worked through some of those kitchen spaces and created food and meals to go for people, anybody who needed them, not just hospitality workers, also trying to get household goods and things like that. So it was kind of great to see, like, that's exactly the kind of work that happens from the ground up, that we're not waiting for government intervention, because it would be, you know, weeks and months out before we started seeing things like the PPP loans and the ARPA funds and things mm-hmm. like that. As we know, government works slowly, but people on the ground work really quickly, and people on the ground really understand what their community needs and what those resources are. And everything is relational. So it's literally was just me finding my own network of friends and acquaintances and just kind of cobbling things together. And that's really the beauty of, I think, nonprofit and community-led organizations is they're nimble, they're agile, and they have their pulse on what their community needs.
So you run for office for a council at-large seat. You win, and not only do you win, but you receive the most votes of any of the council at-large candidates. And in Lexington, Kentucky, the city council is comprised of 12 districted council members and then three other at-large that the whole city elects. And the top vote recipient of those council at-large candidates becomes the vice mayor. So what the heck does the vice mayor do? I think a lot of people don't even know what the role really entails.
Sure. I can understand why there is confusion, because the title honestly really should be more like council president. I do not work for the mayor or in the mayor's administration. I am essentially the leader of our legislative branch, which is the council.
And what sorts of things does that entail to try to lead these other members in the council?
Sure. I have to assign my colleagues to their offices, to committee assignments. I can put items in committee without a vote. I can create task forces and working groups and really kind of help guide and lead some of the agenda, but also, at least in my mind, kind of guiding what the council culture should be, kind of how we should work together. So it is certainly a leadership role, and it left me no room to just kind of wander in on day one and sit back and just watch things. I kind of immediately had to get to work on sort of a different level, but I've really, really enjoyed it.
You mentioned council culture. I'm curious how that impacts the functioning of local government.
You know, council is such an interesting entity because we're elected officials, so we don't have a boss right above us in the hierarchy. Our bosses are the voters, right? We have, you know, 300,000 bosses that we have to answer to. But what that means is there's nobody necessarily really guiding kind of our philosophies or how we work and interact with each other. And one of the things that very often happens in different local governments is councils sometimes end up being rubber stamps for the administration. Mm-hmm. This council in the last, I would say, 4 to 6 years has become the most diverse council we've ever had in Lexington, both in terms of racial demographics. We've had a majority woman council for some years. We have the most members of the LGBTQ community. I'm the first immigrant member of council, first Asian American member of council. And all that to say is the representation has really changed on council, which means we have different voices from different communities, from different lived experiences. And we bring with us a lot of different opinions and different perspectives on looking at things. So anybody who's paying attention to local politics right now knows that we are very opinionated. We're kind of feisty, sometimes messy. But all that is to say, I think Lexington is more widely represented than it's ever been.
What's been the most surprising thing since your time on council and as vice mayor about the role of local government in people's lives? And the follow-up will be, what's a misconception people have about local government that you wish they understood better?
Sure. I'll kind of couch it in this way. I've really enjoyed just about every aspect of what I do as a local legislator. The most frustrating thing has been our relationship and sometimes the power imbalance between us and the state government and then the federal government. You know, there's such a thing as supremacy, which means state laws trump local laws. So sometimes the things that we're trying to do locally don't always line up with the majority in Frankfurt, in our capital. So sometimes the things we do get undone very quickly. We saw that when we passed a ban on source of income discrimination, for example, that kind of immediately got quashed. So that's been a really delicate and challenging balance for us that I didn't really think about before I got into this job. I had this sort of notion of like, yeah, we're local elected leaders elected locally to govern locally, but it's not that simple. We're also seeing that ripple effect now in terms of how we relate to the federal government, in that some of our federal funding is being threatened or at the very least precarious, and that very much impacts what we're able to do in the city because, you know, what I always like to say is how we spend our money is the expression of our values, right? But if we don't have money to spend on these programs and on these efforts, we can't do it. And some of our money does come from the federal level.
And what misconception do you think the general public has about local government that could be understood better?
Yeah, I think people need to understand how much local legislation and local ordinances and local taxes, things like that, really affect people day to day in a way probably more acutely than state or federal level things happening. The state and federal, and particularly the federal, that draws the most attention. That's the stuff that's very salient. That's the stuff that's in our news feeds and in our social media all day long, everything that's coming out of Washington. I really want to refocus people on paying attention to what's happening locally when we're talking about, you know, zone changes and housing developments and solar power and sidewalks and tree canopies and parks and things like that. Those are literally the things that impact us day to day to day. So I would love for people to kind of pay attention to local elections and also to what's happening in City Hall.
You know, that's a consistent theme in the conversations I have on this show, whether it's, you know, people who are focused on national politics or, you know, are in Washington and focus on the federal government, from people at the local level, people in civic health organizations. The consistent message is local government matters to people and affects people maybe more than what the federal government does. And so we need to, I think, reshift our focus as a country onto these local issues. And to that end, can you tell us a story of a time when you think local democracy really worked for people, maybe in a way that is inspiring?
Yeah, I mean, I'll kind of put it this way. So, like, we had something that's seemingly kind of small that happened recently. The city of Lexington has had a longstanding relationship with the UK ROTC to use one of our more rural parks, Heisel Farm Park, as a training site for UK ROTC. So that contract was coming up for renewal, and there's no money that changes hands. We're literally just allowing them to train on our park site. And so, you know, on our docket, usually there's 40 to 60 to 80 items on there, right? Lots of contractual things and not, you know, everything gets a lot of scrutiny. This particular item got onto our docket, and then multiple members of our community came out and kind of spoke against it and talked about why they didn't think this was a good idea or a good partnership for ROTC, both in terms of people who have trauma and PTSD from gun violence and just the idea that these are our parks and refuges where you want to kind of go and get away and have some quiet time, and having folks in camouflage with, you know, fake guns running around, it was not conducive to that. And it made me realize, oh, this is exactly how this direct local government and democracy works, is these folks are kind of bringing to our attention an issue that we may not have been thinking about as lawmakers because we have all these other things on our plates. So I started contacting these folks who came out and spoke, and we talked and talked about some other ideas, and we ended up adjusting that contract down to 6 months and making a commitment that we would not be renewing with them going forward, because it was such a great example of the community coming forward to make us pay attention to something and then also working with us to figure out what that solution was going to be. So it's not a top down from us as lawmakers, the community, here's what we're going to do. And it also wasn't just completely bottom up. It was a very collaborative effort. And it's the kind of access and communication that is often much more difficult on the state and federal level, right? It's very hard to get a meeting with a state representative or with a congressman. So that was just such kind of a beautiful example of how that local democracy should work.
We're speaking with Dan Wu, the vice mayor of Lexington, who just told us that there's an example of the community coming out in force to impact the way the city council looked at an issue. So it does matter when people show up to city council meetings, and it does matter when they contact their council member?
It absolutely does, yeah. I think there's, you know, this is something I think a lot about, too, coming from some organizing spaces. What I really want from grassroots organizers and people in the community to know, at least about this council right now, is that we are very accessible, very, very open to meeting with folks. So you have to kind of figure out what is most impactful. Is it most impactful for me to stand on the street with a sign saying council needs to do this? Or is it more impactful for someone to email their council member and say, hey, I have this issue that I want to talk to you about. Can I get a meeting with you? And let's have a conversation about it and create something productive out of it, right? Both things have value, but I just very much want to emphasize that local government is the most accessible level of government. We are very much open to hearing from folks and working productively towards goals together.
How do we square that with turnout in local elections? I mean, the city council members are elected with turnout that is, in my, this is me editorializing, but I think pathetic as a scholar of voting rights, when, you know, less than half of the electorate shows up to select our leaders. Are you all actually truly representative of all of us? And how do we square this message that contacting the city council member is the way to affect change when the feedback loop that you all receive every 2 years is pretty poor with respect to the number of people actually participating?
Yeah. And I have to say, in recent years, I feel like a lot of what drives turnout is sort of the outrage machine, right? It's because you're pissed off and you're mad at the incumbent, or you're mad at whatever candidate. And all of the national candidates and the national races kind of suck all the oxygen out of the room, so that by the time you're flipping to page two or three, where the council members and the circuit court judges and the county clerk and all the local electeds are, you've kind of lost the attention. And certainly, you know, any ballots where you get to check a party ticket, you don't get us, because, you know, our local elected officials, many of us are nonpartisan, including council and mayor. So if you just check a Democrat or Republican box and walk off, you've not voted for us. Our sort of partisan primary system has that same effect, too. So if you are a registered independent and you don't show up in May to vote for the primary, you've also missed your local races, even though you can show up, even though you can't vote in the Democratic or Republican primary races, you can vote for local. And that's also sort of missed. So there's some systemic stuff that's kind of built that way to kind of favor like the bigger races and kind of have you ignore us. But I think we can also, as a local government, do a better job of communicating to folks what is it exactly that we do every day that is so impactful to the local communities. But overall, you're right. I mean, I would love to see turnout numbers go up. It's very concerning when people are talking about taking away mail-in voting, taking away early voting, all the different increase in access, that being taken away. I was very bummed when post-COVID, we had way longer early voting during COVID, and we kind of took that away. And there was, for me, no reason to limit access to people. The more people that we can get voting, the better for democracy.
What do you think Lexington does well that other cities should consider doing?
Lexington has been set up to succeed by a number of different factors, the biggest of which I think is when we merged city and county government in 1974, we made local government nonpartisan. That is huge. Mm. That is the main reason that I'm where I am today. If we had partisan races for mayor and for council in Lexington, I don't think that I would have run.
Why is that?
Because I'm honestly super, super sick to death of partisan politics in America, the way that it currently operates both on the state and the federal level, to where it's really party over all else, even values. If the Democrats say they like chocolate, suddenly the Republicans have to be the anti-chocolate party. And that might flip suddenly, then maybe the Republicans are the pro-choc. So the values or the issues don't even matter, right? It's just all-out war between parties. What I love about council is we have 15 council members and a mayor. Very often, the voters don't actually know what parties we belong to, which I think is great. We don't caucus, right? There's not a majority and a minority caucus on council. With any given issue, I don't take for granted where any of my colleagues stand on it. If we are saying, hey, we're talking about a proposal to allow large-scale solar in the agricultural zone, right? I can't look at my 15 council members and just look at the R or the D next to their name to know where they stand on the issue. And that's great because I have to go and talk to every single one of my colleagues and say, hey, how do you feel about this particular issue? Can I get your support? What's your objection? How do we work together? So on every issue, it's like that. And you and I may vote the same on one issue and then be on opposing sides the next issue. And I think that is super, super healthy.
Are you optimistic in general about voting and elections during these times?
Shoo, it's it's really hard to be optimistic. It's really, really hard to not lose hope. But I think I come back to whether you're somebody who wants to run for office, whether you're a community organizer, whether you work for a nonprofit or just a regular person. My optimism comes from the fact that when people realize they can make an impact on a local level, you may not be able to effectuate, you know, change to our national immigration policy, for example, right? But you can donate housewares to Kentucky refugee ministries so that a new American family coming in from, you know, a war-torn country can have a microwave and some forks and spoons. You know what I mean? So there are all kinds of different ways that you can participate and help in your communities and in democracy on that local level.
Dan Wu is the vice mayor of Lexington, Kentucky. Dan, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
It's my pleasure.
Lexington's vice mayor, Dan Wu, was just with us. Josh, what did he have to say about the abysmal local voter turnout that we see time and again?
I think he shared my concern that the local community doesn't show up enough for local elections, partly based on the structure of how we do things, the fact that it's at the end of the ballot. If you're just picking a party, you know, a straight ticket party for Democrats and Republicans, you're not voting in city council. And yet, I also found it interesting about how he discussed the importance of showing up to city council meetings, the importance of contacting your local representative. So while I think we both wish voter turnout was much higher in local government, he actually gave me some hope that city council is still responsive to the community and the voices they're hearing in the community based on the emails they receive, based on the conversations they have, and based on the people showing up to city council meetings.
I heard something in your conversation with Dan Wu that really stands out. I wonder if it does for you, too. And he was talking about how fortunate Lexington is in these times to have a nonpartisan local legislature in its Urban County Council. That really stood out to me. Did it to you? Because it's pretty unusual, isn't it?
It did. I mean, on the one hand, we do know that local governments that have a nonpartisan structure where candidates don't run on a party label tend to have lower voter turnout because people use the party label as a proxy for who they want to vote for. And sometimes if you don't know what the people stand for, the names, then you just don't vote. And so I think we do need to do a much better job of educating the public about the candidates' views, about what differences there are among the candidates. On the other hand, he described how it helps local government actually work better for all people, that it doesn't matter what your party label is when thinking about an issue of zoning or an issue of homelessness or an issue of local taxes or whatever it is that actually affects people's daily lives. So I think there are both good and bad things with respect to nonpartisan local elected officials, but I loved how he focused on the positives of this is actually how government is supposed to work. Be responsive to the people and try to make people's lives better.
Josh Douglas, host of Democracy Optimist, a special production of Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. In the next edition of Eastern Standard, more on having a say in what goes on in your community. Eastern Standard contributor Carolyn DuPont will have as her guest Rich Harwood, author of The New Civic Path, Restoring Our Belief in One Another and Our Nation. Here's a passage from their conversation.
How can we move people to focus more on the local rather than the national?
Yeah, so first let me say that, because I think some of your listeners might wonder, like, does this guy think that there's any change necessary at the state and national level or international level? I mean, just pick up any newspaper, look online, or listen to any newscasts, and they're filled with state, national, and international issues. So first, let me just say that I recognize that there is work to be done at those levels. The challenge is we've lost belief in ourselves. We've lost belief in one another. We've lost belief in institutions. We've lost belief in our own religious faith for many of us. And so the question is, how does one restore that sense of belief? And I believe that it's really important to start that locally because in our local communities, we actually have a sphere of influence. We have some modicum of control. We can create things together at a scale that's doable. And those actions, that work is the seedbed for restoring our sense of belief, engendering hope. And that's really critical. That's why I think we need to start locally because we can get things moving and it can grow from there.
That's Carolyn DuPont with Rich Harwood, her guest on the next edition of Eastern Standard, coming up on Thursday, December 4th. We're going to be off next week for the Thanksgiving holiday. We have a lot to be thankful for. That includes you.
What does it mean? To be American? Home of the free.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm your series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond, research assistant, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.